Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 29th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. Good to have you along. So it is hot, hot summer here in Massachusetts. We've had some quite hot days, but I think there is a bigger picture going on that we at least ought to take passing note of, that globally it seems like we were having quite a warm summertime. And I guess since this is a climate show, we don't have to make too many pound the point too hard that climate change is happening in real time. But I've seen some horrendous reports of things going on around the world. That, for example, in Greece, there's a lot of people have died because these wildfires have really taken off. I mean, I haven't even been able to keep up with a lot of the coverage, but have you seen anything about that?
Yes, you see these massive wildfires in Greece that I believe have killed at least 49 people. You have had triple-digit temperatures in Texas, getting up to like 115 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, getting up to 115 degrees. Unbearable heat, though, as we've noted before, scientists predicted would be the consequences of unrestrained carbon pollution. And now you're bearing witness to, there was one news report saying that, the images in Greece look like Dante's Inferno. Right. And if you think about it, when you look at those images of those wildfires, it does call to mind that famous Al Gore line about watching the news being like taking a nature hike through the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, I saw something that said it was 90 degrees Fahrenheit above the Arctic Circle. Did you see anything like that? Am I getting my numbers wrong? Or maybe not. I don't want to commit to 90 degrees, but there's some incredibly hot temperature for in the far northern part of Finland or something, and say, man, this is quite out of line with the expectations of what it should be. I mean, it really is, it's not passé. I mean, it's something that we need to keep saying, but I think most people who have taken the time to come to this podcast know that this stuff is happening in real time, but it's kind of scary to see it play out in front of you.
I mean, and what's going on in Japan too?
The
Japanese heat wave is just has killed at least 10 and hospitalized well over 2,000. There's an extreme heat affecting Sweden, as you mentioned before. The temperatures have hit 90 degrees as far north as the Arctic Circle. Usually around that area, it's in the 60s and 70s this time of year. So it's just completely abnormal. There was a city in Africa where it hit 124 degrees. I mean, again, you're getting to the point where the human body simply cannot abide by that level of heat.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. There will be places that would become uninhabitable. Yeah, I saw something, just to go back to Japan. So the story I remember from Japan was that it had incredible rainstorms, right? Again, climate pumped rain clouds where they had many inches of rain, people died. Then they had an incredible heat wave. And what I saw earlier today was that there's a typhoon now winding up to drive over Tokyo, right? Which would just be one more of these biblical plague kind of things. Mm-hmm. Well, despite the fact that these things are happening, I mean, there's sort of, you were telling me before about American Airlines. DR, tell me that story again.
Yes, so this, if you think about it, a sad and if you think about it, a fairly creepy bit of news that Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen recently mentioned that American Airlines, apparently they previously had a policy whereby they would not allow certain planes to fly at temperatures exceeding 117 degrees, and they had to ground a number of planes last year because, particularly in Phoenix, the temperature got over 117 degrees.
And let me just break in. The reason they have to do that is because the air is so hot that it expands, and so the air is somewhat more rarefied, right? Mm-hmm. And as the airplane rolls down the runway in the 115-degree heat, it cannot develop enough lift to get mm-hmm. off, to take off, right? Because mm-hmm. the air is so thin because it's so hot. And so that's why they have this limitation on 115 degrees is the maximum temperature, because if you go beyond that, you might not be able to get the airplane off the ground. You just fly it into the freeway at the end of the runway. Anyway, continue. Mm-hmm.
So apparently, it has been reported that American Airlines apparently went to Trump's Federal Aviation Administration to ask for, I guess, special permission, special dispensation, like going to the Pope for special dispensation. They went to Pope Donald for dispensation to allow their planes to fly in temperatures up to 123 degrees. And the FAA has granted such permission. So if it's 121 degrees or 122 degrees, American Airlines still plans to take off. And as Brad Friedman famously noted, what could possibly go wrong? What
could possibly go wrong with that? Well, there you go. So amidst this sort of corporate destructiveness that we've seen that goes beyond risking takeoffs and landings because the air is too thin, the Trump administration has gone another step and done another, or plans to at least do another terrible, aggressive blow to the planet. And that has to do with, I'll set it up, DR, and you can describe what's happened. But historically, from the 1970s on, the Clean Air Act, because when the Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, Californian air was so much dirtier than the rest of the nation. California was given a special exemption to have more aggressive emissions control standards on their automobiles than the rest of the country. And of course, over the years, the rest of other states, in particular Massachusetts and New York and many of the large eastern states, all set a standard that they agree with California, and any cars sold in their states must follow the emissions standards that California gets to set. And that's been going on for 50 years now. And between California and the other 13 states that have joined it, it's something like one third of the national market for automobiles has a much more aggressive standard for fuels than the rest of the country. And the Obama administration collaborated with California and set up rather aggressive efforts to get, I think it was 50 miles per gallon in automobiles by 2025 or something like that, right? But the policy had the Obama name on it. And so the Trump administration, tell me, DR, what did the Trump administration announce or show its intention to do this week?
Well, it was reported by Bloomberg and the Washington Post that the Trump administration wants to get rid of California's waiver under the Clean Air Act to have more fuel efficient, to essentially have more fuel efficient vehicles, and they want to wipe out to the greatest extent possible everything Obama was trying to do to improve fuel efficiency standards. The Bloomberg reports that the EPA is going to propose revoking the Clean Air Act waiver granted to California that has allowed the state to regulate emissions from vehicle tailpipes and force car makers to sell a minimum number of electric vehicles in the state. I mean, if you remember that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? Now they could make another sequel saying that Trump is trying to kill the electric car by virtue of this proposal. Right. And this will inevitably end up in court. And obviously the Trump administration feels very, very confident that they can stick Brett Kavanaugh on the bench and therefore get a 5-4 ruling, allowing them to sort of destroy California's ability to protect the air and protect the climate.
One more reason to call your senator and tell him we don't want Brett Kavanaugh. Yeah, but so I saw an interesting article by Dave Roberts at Vox, who basically, I don't know if it's sour grapes or just increasing kind of a steely resolve about what's going on. But he points out that conservatives who have used the issue of states' rights, the 10th Amendment in states' rights, in quotation marks, local control, they have used that argument against social justice progress, against all kinds of progress. In fact, Scott Pruitt, the unlamented Scott Pruitt, was recently insisting that states had the right to reduce their pollution standards because of the states' rights, the right of the state to have some control over its territory written into the Constitution, blah, 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 blah. But when it turns out that the states' rights argument goes against, counter to the policy wishes of conservatives, they all of a sudden forget it. So the idea that somehow we're going to go in and crush California's right to have its own emission standards, or it's just so hypocritical. And it just proves that for these people on the other side, every principled argument they pretend to make is in fact a argument that's specific to the goal they want to achieve, and they have no more allegiance to the idea of states' rights than they have to anything else. What they want is the end game. Is that a fair statement, DR? Do you agree?
It's federalism for me, but not for thee. That's basically the mentality. And I'm surprised David Roberts didn't bring up this point. This is far from the first time we've seen this. The most dramatic example one can think of is can occurred 15 years ago in Massachusetts, when the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court said that same-sex couples had the right under state law to get married. And what did people on the right do? They proposed federal marriage amendments to sort of take away Massachusetts' right to treat same-sex couples equally and impose a nationwide big government ban on same-sex marriage. So you're seeing a similar version of the logic here.
Right. And again, just pointing out the hypocrisies of the other guy, which is maybe easier than pointing out your own. But nonetheless, a lot of conservatives were insistent that states should not provide safe sanctuary. You know, sanctuary cities where there's outrage that had to be squashed from the federal level. Whereas if it had been something else, then if it was, say, the Sagebrush Rebellion in the Great American West, it would have been local control. And again, it just proves that these guys don't have any principles. They want specific results, and they'll use and pretend their principled arguments to get what they want.
I mean, what Trump is proposing is quite literally, in the textbook definition of the term, the tyranny of big government.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where's the Tea Party? Where are they at? Where's the Tea Party at?
I know. We will follow this. I think you're right that this is going to get bogged down in court, although if they just fight it up to Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, a Kavanaugh Supreme Court will, you know, do whatever. I mean, they said Kavanaugh thought that the decision that Nixon had to surrender the tapes was wrongly decided in 1970. Mm-hmm. I mean, unbelievable stuff. But just as a, you know, segue off, you should call your senator and tell them that to not vote on Kavanaugh until all of his voluminous email record is made public and reviewed. Anyway, put that aside. That's so I guess Trump is being Trump again, has to be stopped. Hopefully we will do that, but it is an outrage. Tell me, DR, the other side of the coin was a potential, possible, maybe glimmer of hope, or maybe it was just more hypocrisy. This past week, there was certainly Republican members of the House of Representatives who signed on, at least temporarily, to a modified, limited sort of climate carbon tax bill, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me the story about the carbon tax bill in the House of Representatives and what you think people ought to think about it.
Well, two Republican members of Congress, Carlos Curbelo of Florida and Brian Fitzpatrick of, I believe, Pennsylvania, have proposed legislation known as the Market Choice Act. According to Reuters, the legislation would, according to Curbelo, exceed the carbon reduction goals of the Paris Climate Agreement by imposing a levy of $24 per metric ton on CO2 emissions beginning in 2020 and rising annually. It would eliminate the federal gasoline tax and the federal aviation fuel tax. And according to Curbelo, the tax would generate $700 billion in revenue over a decade for infrastructure investments. And as part of this proposed legislation, there would be a delay, a suspension of, in effect, of the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Now how do you suspend a Supreme Court ruling? That's an interesting legal thing, but essentially what they're saying is that they're going to basically tell the legislation would tell the EPA to stand down on regulating greenhouse gases. Now this occurred just days after the House of Representatives in what I believe was a 229 to 180 vote voted in favor of a sense of the House resolution by Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana denouncing the concept of carbon taxes. And the reason why I bring that up is that in the press conference of the National Press Club announcing this legislation, Curbelo insisted, he made two really questionable assumptions. Number one, he insisted that the moratorium on the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions would provide what he called regulatory certainty. And as David Roberts has noted in another context, the term regulatory certainty is always a red herring and is always nonsense. But the other thing that frankly infuriated me is his insistence in this press conference that members of his party and members of the House who, you know, for a long, long time have rejected any effort to address carbon pollution, are now ready to come to the table. Mm-hmm. There is frankly no evidence of that. In fact, where there's evidence to the opposite by virtue of that vote for the Scalise resolution. So when Curbelo insists that there's, you know, this massive groundswell, the secret bipartisan support for his legislation, I'll believe it when I see it, and I doubt I'm going to see it.
So you think... Why do you think they did it? Is it a Curbelo, I think, is in a South Florida district where they have king tide flooding already, right? So is that just a ploy to get reelected? Or do you think that it is has any virtue or nobility behind it?
Prior to the vote on the Scalise Amendment, I thought that, you know, this was on the up and up. But after the Scalise Amendment and after his remarks, and even before his remarks, the fact that he was continuing to push this, I do wonder if there's a bit of local politics involved. He is in a reelection campaign in a congressional district that Hillary Clinton won by 16 points. He has a likely Democratic opponent who has been attacking him for, among other things, voting in favor of the big tax cut bill that cleared a path for drilling in Anwar, and basically saying that, you know, how can you claim to be a climate champion when you voted for a bill that's going to clear a path for drilling in Anwar? And you do wonder if this is an attempt by Curbelo to basically pull off what certain other politicians have done, is saying, you can trust me, I'm not like the others. I'm not like one of those, you know, bad, you know, denialists out there. You know, it's a way to basically, you know, launder and babyface his image, I think. But, hey, I could be proven wrong. I doubt I will be, but I could be proven wrong.
So I've heard the counter-argument that says this is the beginning of the shift of conservative thinking towards at least countenancing some sort of... action on climate. Although I agree with you, it seems like it's too small. And of course, it's always accompanied with this thing about taking the EPA off the case, right? It's not. And I think to me that leads it to be not credible as a true intent to address climate change, because the first thing they want to do is get the EPA off the case, right? Oh, we're going to have a carbon tax, but first the EPA is going to stand down. I don't buy it.
And here's yet another example, and I'm surprised a lot of people have not brought this up, of the fraudulence of the claim that Republicans are beginning to embrace, you know, climate solutions. It was 7 years ago this summer that, you know, climate hawks were pointing to, you know, John Huntsman. John Huntsman was like one of the only Republicans to say, hey, we still need to do something about climate change when everybody else is going denialist. Now, what is John Huntsman doing today? He's the ambassador, he's the U.S. ambassador to Russia, the same country that, as you've noted before, is through Putin's alliance with Trump is trying to promote fossil fuels. You don't see Huntsman talking about climate change today, do you? You'll never hear him talk about it again. That's just one of several of point after point after point, abundant examples. You'll run out of time discussing the examples of all the incentives in Curbelo's party running away from climate, right, from climate progress, and running towards more of a defense, a full-throated defense of the fossil fuel industry.
Well, let's end our show with a little tiny tidbit of good news. At least I think it's good news. So over the last few years, if you've been following the bouncing ball on clean energy stuff, you will know that the automaker VW got caught red-handed with software that was tricked up to fool the auto emissions tests and get good automotive mileage ratings, even though in practice the software let you drive, you go zoom, zoom, zoom all you want with and polluting. VW got caught. They had to spend pay a lot of money, and a lot of that money got divided up and is being sent back to states that have people who bought electric vehicle bought VWs. And it turns out that the first tranche of that money, I think it's like $75 million coming in from VW, will go into the state of Massachusetts, will be funneled towards buying electric buses for, I think it's Martha's Vineyard and the Pioneer Valley. And other things that will happen with that money is to increase the number of electric vehicle charging stations. Again, that's good. I mean, in this case, VW had to pay the piper, and we will end up with some more clean energy here. I guess my only complaint about the use of this money so far is that, well, I want the Pioneer Valley and Martha's Vineyard to get electric buses. I want everyone to have electric buses, and maybe this is some sort of a test case for Massachusetts, but I think that Shanghai has already got like 500 electric buses driving around the city, so it's not as if they need that much testing. And you know, the big urban centers are the places that need the buses and need the money. And how come we're not buying electric buses for them? Anyway, that's a complaint. But still in all, it's a good piece of news that we're buying electric buses in Massachusetts. Right? Did you see any of that, DR?
Exactly. And, you know how the Volkswagen used to run those commercials talking about the German term Fahrvergnügen, which is basically referring to like driving, the pleasure of driving. I think people are going to enjoy the pleasure of driving or being in a clean vehicle as opposed to one of Volkswagen's dirtier vehicles.
And my German is not very good, but it could be E-Bus Gnugen or something would be the correct word. All right. Well, look, DR, we got to put it down there. We'll put up links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. We're also on Facebook at /massclimateaction, where you can see a lot of other interesting stuff, including the opportunity to call your state representatives and tell them that we want the 3% RPS and that there is a something called the Comprehensive Energy Plan that is asking for comments. And even though the deadline to submit comments is 5 or 6 days away, they haven't actually shown the draft plan yet. But that's, you don't need a draft plan. You just call. Anyway, so there's lots going on. You can listen to this show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, etc. And, of course, you can catch us on Apple Podcasts. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.